This episode is brought to you by NordVPN. Listen up, nerds. No. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea.
What?
Hello, friends. Do you have a computer? Of course you do, because it's not 1987. Hell, you're listening to this on some kind of computer right now. But do you have a VPN?
Oh,
what's a VPN, you ask? Well, my friend, a VPN is a virtual private network and it offers two key benefits: enhanced privacy and security online. But VPNs do a lot more than that. VPNs shield your IP address, change your browsing location, and make online life easier. It's all about safety and security, my friends. But like everything else in life, it's also about watching TV. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. I use NordVPN to access my home content while I'm traveling. Wink, wink. Plus, secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you go when you're traveling. There's over 6,300 servers in 111 countries, and you can find a nearby server for the best VPN speeds. NordVPN is easy to use. Connect with one click or enable auto-connect for zero-click protection. And it's got amazing speed. NordVPN is one of the fastest VPNs out there. And with just one NordVPN account, you can use it on 6 devices. It supports every major platform: Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, even Android TV. I think those are all real. Don't miss out on all the awesome benefits for using a VPN. Go to nordvpn.com/ifanboy today for a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. The link's in the show notes. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/ifanboy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/ifanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 325, brought to you by C2E2 and iFanboy members like you.
I got up this morning, put on my shoes, tied my shoes, went to the mirror, put a comb in my hair, I made a move, know what to do, try to break and run.
Hello, welcome to the iFanboy.com Pick of the Week podcast. It's episode 325. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. I'm here with Ron Richards.
Hello.
And Josh Flanagan.
Hello.
We are at fanboy.com. We like comics. We read comics. Everyone can read a bunch of comics. One of us is charged with picking the best one they read, writing about the website, when we talk about the podcast, along with other books of the week, topics of interest, emails, voicemails, all kinds of fun things that go on during the show. It's fun. It's a fun thing. It's not a sad thing. It's a fun thing.
It's a positive force in your life.
It's a positive thing.
Connor categorizes everything in his life as either fun or sad.
Fun or sad. This yes. Dinner was sad. Before we get to the show, quick reminder and a warning. We'll be talking about the books and what happened in them. There'll be spoilers, so if you haven't read your books, pause the show, come back, or utilize the show notes. That'll be a fun thing for you, too. Not a sad thing. So be careful is what I'm saying. Josh, you had to pick.
I did have the pick. I also picture that Werner Herzog does everything as fun or sad. The book was a sad thing for me. Timothy Treadwell was also sad. But Swamp Thing number 7 was a happy thing. This was one of those weeks where I had a bunch of contenders that I could have written the pick of the week about. Some more expected, some unexpected, and I didn't think to go for Swamp Thing at first. And then I looked at it and I thought about it, and I was like, you know, he's never had a pick of the week on this book. We've written all sorts of stuff. No, yeah, this was his honorary Oscar. This was his departed Oscar. No, it wasn't that. But I was thinking about it, and I also had nothing bad to say about this book. Basically, like there was no detractors. It was well done all around, and it's kind of interesting because in comparison to the Marco Rudy stuff from before, which is fine, it works fine for me. But when you get the real deal Yannick Paquette stuff, you're like, okay, this guy's got it going on here. He knows.
He's Yannick Paquette is going somewhere that I personally have never seen him go before on this book. And this issue, I think, was the furthest he's gone with it.
And I think that's important because it fits.
Yep.
Let's address this right away. I saw a lot of comments, and I have made this comment in the past that the layouts are actually not as user friendly as you might expect because they're pretty odd and they go all over the place. But I would then submit to you that it almost fits because when you're talking about the green and you're talking about the Parliament of Trees and all this stuff, like their reality isn't the same as ours. This may be complete BS, but it's a way that I can justify it for myself a little bit. Like it just changes and stretches time around in the way that a comic book page can. It moved things around a little bit. You know what you're doing. One of the things that I found really interesting about this issue, to be completely honest, right away, I was blown away by the art and the coloring specifically. I was looking, I was like, this is a really well produced book, and I noticed the coloring, which you're not supposed to do, but you are supposed to do. Like I was just like the palette is magnificent throughout the whole thing, and for whatever reason, this sort of off-putting layouts, which is also, you know, they're also very imaginative, it actually works for me because the whole thing takes place between like the spirits of some trees and a naked dude. There's nothing happening. The whole issue. And there's been other issues in this run so far where I was like, okay, it was too much explaining. There was too much talking. But this didn't have that problem. Every, you know, I was down for every page in this, and I didn't feel like I was stuck in a, you know, way to get through pages while explaining stuff. And at the end, a thing happened, and you know, Swamp Thing has wings now, and it's on. what I really liked, though, is that we spent all this time with Alec Holland, and I like him. He's an interesting character. He's different than all of these other characters in the DCU. He's been around for a long time, but you know, for all intents and purposes, he's new for most of the people reading this. And he's done now. That version of him is gone, and I like that's a big change. That's a real thing. He's not going to switch back. There's not going to be a Swamp Thing and an Alec Holland. The Alec Holland, you know, he had to make the choice, and they laid it out why he was doing that, and. Now he's made that choice and he's going to be done now. He's Swamp Thing now because it was the thing that he had to do. And basically, I just enjoyed this all the way through, and I thought that it was a nice cap to what has actually been a really long sort of arc, I guess. If you think about it in terms of all the other books that have come out of the relaunch, you know, some of the stories as they get into 5, 6, 7 issues for an arc are a little long in the tooth. Some of them changed gears drastically and did something else for a couple issues and came back. I'm talking about Action Comics, but you know, like this one story, it's held my interest the entire time, just as has its sort of companion book, as I'll refer to it, Animal Man. It's not speeding through it, but I'm also not getting bored at the same time. And that makes it a pretty good book. It's you know, not a 2 or 3 issue arc. They're really taking their time and doing something that is different than what's happening in a lot of these superhero books. I know that Superman showed up in the first issue, was it? Or first or second?
Yep.
You know, but for the most part, this is happening elsewhere, and it's not being affected by all that. Not that I know what time any of the stuff in this world is happening. But I've just enjoyed it as a way that it's definitely built on what Alan Moore did before it, and honestly, if you didn't, that would be a waste. That would be foolish. But at the same time, it's brought in something new with this sort of organic version of the different colored rings with the rot and the red and the all that stuff. I've really enjoyed it, and I just think this was probably the strongest issue we've seen yet since the first one.
It was an artistic tour de force on the level of G.H. Williams.
Yeah. I mean,
And I think that in this book, more than any, the page layouts being crazy and organic and plant-like work because that's the essence of the character. I mean, you don't get a better pairing of the pure construction of the page and character in that. Yeah. The panels flow like vines. And it's tough to follow. I had a couple of instances where I thought I was reading a two-page spread and I read across and realized I wasn't. But, you know, that's the nature of the beast, and it wasn't the worst thing in the world. I just went back and read them in the proper order and it was fine. But
you see what I mean? Like, it kind of works. Like
it didn't really matter because it was so impressive to begin with, and if it happens twice in the course of an issue, it's not the worst thing that can happen to anything.
It happened to me on another book, and I forgot what it was.
It wasn't like it was in the middle of an action scene in some other book where you have to know what's happening, or some sort of, you know, like courtroom debate or something. You can't have it happen there, but in this, it works for me.
You can't have that.
Can't have it.
You know, what I liked is that the artistic level that Paquette got to, and then the use of they're ostensibly panel borders, like the vine-like panel borders, and it also gave it and the cover kind of speaks to this as well. It gave it a 70s psychedelic kind of feel,
wavy gravy.
Yeah, totally wavy gravy, and I loved the flip between the scenes in the Parliament of the Trees in the green and what was going on in the red or the rot or whatever with that creepy baby head,
that was the creepiest thing I've seen in the comic maybe ever.
Yeah, that was creepy, but how he continued to use that organic panel separation, but in this case these thick black. Mm-hmm. With red highlight kind of swaths of lines and stuff like that. It stayed consistent depending on where you were in the story. It was just really, really impressive visually. So yeah.
And again, to add to that, I think the color really added a ton to this because
Nathan Farabon did a great job. Yeah,
yeah. You really knew where you were based on how the coloring was working, and the greens stand out against everything else as they should.
Yeah,
I think story-wise, it was an artistic tour de force, but story-wise, you've had a 7-issue, hero's journey, and this is the point of the story where Alec does the heroic thing, which is to sacrifice his life to become Swamp Thing to save the day, and you basically had the "I'm coming and hell's coming with me" moment. You know, mm-hmm. that was fantastic. You know, the monster's back, and now you're fucked, and it was very exciting in that sense too. So it was really not, you know, I think the art was really what did it, but story wise it's still
absolutely
quite excellent.
And
now this, you know, they've been teasing this as an all new Swamp Thing, one you're not going to be used to. And I'm really curious because you don't really get to see him. You see him in little bits and pieces, but you don't get a full shot of him. And he's got wings, and we've seen his he can be fairly brutal. And in this issue, plus in Brightest Day when he killed all those oil executives. So I mean, we're really not sure what we're in for, and neither is the rot. So that's going to be fun next issue.
Yeah. It was a pretty perfect issue, and it was impressive in lots of different ways. So it was an easy 5 stars, and then when I started thinking about it, I was like, this is the pick of the week. There it is, and most of the community agreed, as we'll get to.
I think it's awesome we're talking about a Swamp Thing book,
isn't it?
Sure. Yeah.
And like the thing is, it's not like there haven't been attempts,
right?
You know, since then. Although I don't know if there have been since we've been doing the show. We would have read it. They did a lot in the first half of the 2000s. Several that didn't go, but they weren't terribly memorable by people you know. Also, so
He's hard.
Anyway, so this week also marked the launch of Jonathan Hickman's new ongoing series at Image, The Manhattan Projects, with artist Nick Patara, who he worked on the Red Wing, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
he was the guy on the Red Wing. Wow. The Red Wing.
Please, before we begin, Red Wing.
So this focuses on the World War II era, the Manhattan Project, which we all know was the work of the government to build the atom bomb with Dr. Oppenheimer and all that sort of stuff. This takes a spin on that and realizes that was just one piece of a larger project going on in the military, deep, that not many people know about, mainly doing crazy ideas to protect the country, and it's called the Manhattan Projects. And focuses on the recruitment of Robert Oppenheimer, and this is a taking history historical fiction, taking history and twisting it and making it, you know, not true. But by the end of this issue, I loved it.
It wasn't even enough that it could have been just a, you know, we do also other stuff here. Here's the crazy science stuff we're doing. Einstein's locked in the basement. We're all doing fun stuff. But then the other twist is that it's not really Oppenheimer. It's Oppenheimer's evil twin who killed him. Yep. And it's taken his place. I mean, so there's lots of things going on here, and I was not expecting that.
Yep.
It was really fun.
It was, and he accomplished a lot in a.
This was dense.
Yeah, like in a few number of pages. I gotta say, I often really like Hickman's creator-owned stuff, especially at the beginning. He's done more number one creator-owned issues that were excellent than most of the guys out there. Some of them, I feel like he tried to end him too fast, and that would be my criticism of a bunch of them. But this has been my favorite one since Pax Romana, which has been my favorite one. So you know,
and it's ongoing.
Is that it? Yeah.
Yeah. No. This and
well,
Secret,
then I guess
the
he won't have
both...
that. He won't have that problem.
Exactly. Yeah. No. As opposed to, and it's interesting because if you look at, you know, Hickman did those miniseries at Image. Those were calculated. It was like to get himself out there. Look what he can do. Mixing the stuff, and it led to the Marvel work. But now that he's somewhat established, and I talked to him at Image Expo, this is ongoing. Secret is ongoing, and it's a monthly book. Here we go. So it's gonna be interesting to see what he does in a non-limited format. Longer term story, you know, but this, talk about the potential of this. Like you said, Connor, there's just so much going on of all these little different rooms where stuff is going on as they're walking through the project, the project headquarters. And then you get this Japanese attack of robot samurais.
At that moment, I thought, well, this is it now. He's the American Grant Morrison.
Yeah.
Or you know, like Grant Morrison, Warren Ellis, like that's what this feels like, and no one has been able to recapture that in as long as I've been reading comics, and that in itself is pretty impressive, but it really felt like that kind of book and that sort of really unique voice, and that's on top of what I think is probably stronger structure than Morrison does.
Yeah.
But when I saw the samurai robot show up, and you know Oppenheimer manned the gun. You know, coldly man. The guy, he does not like to be touched by a robot. Offensive. That was great.
And again, talking about colors, the colorist on this is Chris Peter, who I've never heard of, but utilizing the blue and the red palette to identify those pages to explain the Oppenheimer, the twin brothers, and then utilizing the subtle shift of color, you know, at the very end.
On the close-ups on the eyes, you can see the red behind them. It's a dead giveaway.
Really, really good. Really good storytelling. And Patara, a very kind of cartoony kind of approach, you know, like, and it was funny because when I interviewed Jonathan Hickman at Image Expo, he said he felt this was more suited for Patara than the Red Wing, because Red Wing was more technical and ships and equipment, while this is more character-based and personal and relationships. I thought – I didn't have a problem with him on the Red Wing, and I thought this was interesting to see him do these kind of conversations, and that's sort of the subtle kind of, you know, that Einstein grin. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, great. And like little subtle personality touches. So it's interesting to see Patara grow as an artist as well. So
yeah, and I, you know, this was almost pick of the week. I almost made this pick of the week. I gave this one 5 stars as well. It was a pretty good start, but you know, there's a lot to go. We'll see what happens next. Yeah. But it was a hell of a first step.
Yeah. So Rachel Rising number 6 came out, and I don't know with the shipping whether everyone got it or not or whatnot, but it's been a while since we talked about it. Terry Moore's thriller or horror or whatever, chilling kind of book. It's been plugging along on that, you know, kind of consistent kind of basis, but it's starting to take a turn towards the chilling. I'm starting to get it. You know, like, and when you've got this battered woman with a snake coming out of her mouth attacking somebody, that's kind of awesome. It's interesting to see Terry Moore go in a less lighthearted direction. And not only that, but at the end of the issue, there's a car accident. One of my worst nightmares happens with a car crashing into a truck carrying a bunch of rebar.
Rebar.
Oh, God.
God, you're not wrong. Rebar is the most terrifying substance on Earth, like short of nuclear waste.
It really is, actually.
Yeah, it flies quickly. It is slim. Yeah. It's very,
John
very
Frankenheimer
dense.
That died from that.
Possibly, I don't know.
One of those big time '70s.
Did you hear that? Ron doesn't want to know.
The tone
of his voice was, "Let's just stop this conversation now because it's too real for me to deal with."
But Rachel, the main character, she gets a rebar right through her gut and she pulls it out.
Is that what we call it? A rebar? I don't know if it needs an article. A piece of rebar or rebar.
Yeah.
She gets rebar through her.
Rebarred.
We're not men of construction. We don't know the words for this. Like, you know, give me the drill piece. That's a bit. Whatever.
All I know is I see those rods of metal and the ridges and
they waver just a little bit. You know, they're just a little bit flexible because they're long.
Yeah. Oh, whenever I see a truck transporting them, I get the hell out of the way. For this reason, this plain reason. So.
At the very least, you're going to have to get a tetanus shot. At the very least.
So good on Terry Moore for tapping into one of my fears.
It's probably covered in like little metal filings from when it was cut.
Oh, stop.
That would be infections. That would be a really good name for like a low budget torture porn.
Little metal filings?
Just no, rebar. Oh, yeah. I'm not even kidding. That's great. I hate horror though. I'm not writing it.
Yeah, anyway.
But I'm enjoying it. I mean, generally I don't really like horror stuff, but like that this issue I was like, all right, I'm getting pulled in. There's something spooky going on with where she was buried. There's a tie to witches of back in the, you know, hundreds of years ago. You got the rebar.
Who'd have thought there'd have been a rebar tangent? That's the magic of this show right there.
Oh, rebar.
Way back when they announced Men of War, I want to say Men at War, but it's not that. I thought, oh, this could be a book I could get into, and then it wasn't. So this issue came out, and we had James Robinson on one of the stories with Phil Winslade doing the whole thing, including coloring himself, and then J.T. Krull and Scott Collins on the second story. And this was much more what I had in mind when they first announced the book. And at first glance, it feels like it's kind of simple and kind of slight. But then the more I thought about it, the more I liked that, because that felt like an old war comic. And that's what this felt like. This felt like a classic war comic. And once again, I think we've seen when you try to shoehorn James Robinson in with the superhero books that everybody else is doing, it doesn't feel right. It's not his thing. But when you let him do something like this, which is just a story of one soldier going out to kill the bad guy, you know, it's a little bit retro and simplistic, but it's also really satisfying, and it worked really well. At the same time, I thought that the Winslade art that he'd done himself was kind of raw and cool and fun. You know, it was. I don't think it was even like anatomically perfect, but like there was all sorts of action and there was a big fight, and I had a ton of fun with it. I even found myself coming to enjoy the second half written by J.T. Krull. I think some of the dialogue definitely needed a rework, but by the end I was sort of down with it, and I enjoyed it. It was a story about a soldier coming home and having a hard time, which we've heard a billion times, but really by the end of it, it was something a little bit good. And I really liked this issue a lot, which I haven't been able to say about any of the Men of Wars so far.
Who knew?
Somebody knew.
So this week also wrapped up Avengers Children's Crusade with issue number 9, the book that started, God, back in 2010? It had to have been. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
And this also is one of four things you absolutely must read before Avengers vs. X-Men. So whether or not you need to or not, take that with a grain of salt. Personally, I don't think you need to read. I mean, I haven't read Avengers vs. X-Men.
Ron, there was a very important word balloon in here that said,
"Yeah,
we're fine with the X-Men for now."
Yeah, right.
For the moment, that was in the word. So,
but this ended on a, you know, the sound when you deflate a balloon. that's if I could review this book, that's what the review would be.
This is one of my favorite minis. I think I picked it twice over the course of its run, but this was very much epilogue because it was mostly just people standing around talking.
The last half of the series has been a complete and total clusterfuck. It's been a complete and total. They've been in front of Avengers Mansion for like four issues arguing and talking and all this sort of stuff. And yes, you had the reveal with Doom and all this sort of stuff, but like it is just it deflated it the balloon noise because it didn't deliver on anything. And furthermore, this issue, as much as I hate to say it, as much as I love Jimmy Chung, this is not Jimmy Chung's best work. I mean, like, even opening up to the first page and that panel with Scott Lang holding Cassie. And look at the Wolverine behind him. Like, it's there's a lot of little rushed panels here and there. And as a Chung fan, I noticed, like, they stick out because he's so good on the good panels. And it just I don't know. This whole thing left a bad, bad taste in my mouth. Like, a really bad taste in my mouth.
Heinberg!
I know, right?
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So they dissolved the Young Avengers with this miniseries? Is that what happened?
Well, I don't know
because they break up and the ones that are left are just they said now you're Avengers.
So. Yeah, I guess so. Maybe who knows? I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they trump it out again, but
with new characters.
Well, yeah, and maybe they've got the four that they can still base it off of. But like, what you know? But I don't know. It's all. And my other observation was, man, what would a Marvel artist do without the Highline? Recently, have you noticed that?
They said, yeah, there's a lot of scenes in the Highline.
Every comic has a talking scene on the Highline.
There's a lot of photo reference available for it.
Yeah, no. I don't know. I had really, really high hopes for this, and it didn't really deliver for me. And so I'm annoyed.
I'm sorry.
And I'm upset.
Do you want to talk about it? Or maybe just do the sponsor read?
Yeah, maybe I could do that. What might get me excited and happy again would be C2E2, which is the biggest pop culture event in Chicago of the year. It's April 13th to the 15th at the McCormick Place. And if you are a comic fan or a pop culture fan, you definitely you're near the Chicagoland area. I've been to Chicago. I know they call it the Chicagoland area.
It's just everything.
You definitely need to show up and check this out. They're going to have tons of guests like Axel Alonso, Joe Quesada, Dan Slott, Jason Aaron, Scott Snyder, Rick Remender, Neil Adams, Tim Sale, Amanda Connor, Ryan Stegman, Sean Murphy, and many, many more. They're all listed over on the C2E2 website at C2E2.com. If you're into pop culture and things like that, they're going to have C-3PO himself, Anthony Daniels, will be there, and he'll be very polite. Nicholas Brendan from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Xander from Buffy will be there. The dad from Teen Wolf,
not James him. Say it.
And Mr. McFeely from Mr.
Delivery.
How did that get booked? It's just like, listen, we got a line of McFeely. Let's get him.
That's what it was.
Oh, God.
Somebody's like, I got McFeely. Do it. Call him in. Make it happen.
They've recently announced they've got expanded free shuttle services to help you get to and from the con, because if you've ever been to Chicago, you know McCormick Place is not near anything.
it's in Chicagoland.
So those shuttle services might be good. And if you've got an iPhone or an Android phone or an iPad or a tablet or some sort of thing, check out C2E2 Mobile, which is a bunch of mobile apps that has maps of the con floor and programming listings and all the stuff you need to stay connected to the con. Kids 12 and under are free on Sunday. So if you've got families and you want to bring your kids, do it on Sunday. Go to C2E2.com where you can buy tickets in advance. You can get the tickets for the weekend for $50. And they also have day rates and things like that. But they've also got VIP packages with a ton of perks and early access to the floor or con floor and things like that. So if you're in Chicago and you haven't bought your tickets yet, do so now. It's all at c2e2.com.
Cool. Let's hear Ron talk more.
Well, no, just I feel like we need a segment. We need like a bumper or something like that for a Michael Lark alert.
Oh, why did they never tell me?
Defenders, it's in the solicitations, man. Read the comics page.
It's a fraction book.
Defenders number 4 featured art by Michael Lark and was mainly focused on Doctor Strange and his lovemaking.
Oh.
But it also kind of continued the weird metal device thing that they found, and Doctor Strange trying to figure it out. And I don't know, but the Lark art was lovely to read. So
that is appropriate considering the old Michael Lark character we used to have on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. The thing about him is that he does not do any books anymore. And I would like him to find a book and stick on that book.
He just does these quick one night stands. Almost.
Yeah, that's the thing. And I understand because you do not want to be tied down or whatnot. But but the thing is, I am not going to look at a Defender book because it is written by the man Matt Fraction. I do not like his book usually. So yeah. I'm just going to gloss over. No, I need someone to tell me. But I wouldn't have bought it anyway.
It was good art, though. It was good. So.
He's good at art.
He Action is good Comics, at art.
Action Comics number 7.
Yeah.
Was the frustrating thing about this book is that there's glimpses of greatness, and this is one of those issues.
Yes.
Where it felt very much like the first issue.
Yep.
And if it only if this whole series had been this way, we'd still be talking about this as the best book of the relaunch.
Yeah.
But instead, it's a book all about missed chances. But this is great. The Rags art was solid. You had a lot of, you know, the old Superman, old school Superman kind of – he's depowered. He's got to – it's hard to get into space. He's
that was awesome. The opening sequence where he's got to get into space, and so they give him an oxygen tank because I guess he doesn't know that he can breathe in space. And
or he can't breathe in space.
Or, yeah, maybe he can. Who knows? And he runs, goes really fast, and then goes off a tow truck ramp and jumps and then proceeds to jump off of satellites to continue forward momentum. Like that opening sequence, I was like, yes, this is what I want.
And we have a reason for him having a costume because, you know, all this physical exertion is hell on his shoes and his jeans and his T-shirt. So, I mean, it all sort of fit into place in what you wanted and what the promise of that first issue was. And unfortunately, it hasn't been that way. But this was a fantastic issue. If you enjoyed that first issue and you were looking for more of that kind of thing, yeah. This was.
And not only did the need for the costume get explained, but also the connection to Krypton and, you know, like explained where the costume came from. I mean, like this, like you said, if this series from the get-go had been stories like this or continued that momentum of when it initially started, I would have been totally on board loving it. If as of last issue, I was ready to drop it. But after this issue, I was like, yes.
And I even saw that this issue was like that. And I thought, you know what? They're just going to do it again. Yeah. And it's going to, I don't know.
Just going to sting.
Yeah.
But speaking of stinging, Justice League International number 7.
Mm-hmm.
What was one of the best things to come out of the great Justice League International revival that we experienced last year? Connor.
Booster Gold.
No, not Booster Gold. The Russian dude.
Oh, the Russian dude. Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Dead.
Yeah.
Killed him.
Yeah. Well, the last issue ended with a big explosion. They were having a speech at the UN and somebody blew it up and you wondered who would live and who would die, and they only killed one person.
Yeah, but they killed the one person that I liked.
Yeah, I know.
Like they didn't kill August General Iron of China, who I can't stand.
He's covered in iron.
Yeah, I know. An international incident.
Yeah. I understand he's the one who's like kind of expendable because he didn't have the direct connections, but he was the comedy relief.
That's true. He was. He was a fun character. He's a good character. I don't know. This book is sometimes fun, sometimes not fun. Yeah. They're adding, looks like they're getting rid of Batman, replacing him with Batwing, which makes sense for the international portion of the team. But, this series is on a case by case basis with me.
Yeah, no, I'm in the same place. Yeah, it's little flashes of what I liked originally about it when I got into it, but it hasn't been nearly as consistent as I want it to be, you know. So anyway, so Hell Yeah number 1 from Image Comics came out. Joe Keating and Andre, I'm not going to pronounce that last name.
Szymanowicz. I don't know.
So my kind of take on Hell Yeah, and I don't know if you guys read it or not, but it's basically I like – the first issue intrigued me. I liked where it's going. I think the art was a little rough in a few places.
The coloring
I think was
the art and the color was rough the whole time, I think.
Yeah. There were a couple pages that were good. That's the thing. There were a couple pages where I was like, oh, well, if it was like that, if the whole book was like that, then it'd be good, then this would be better. You know, I liked the flashback. I thought was well done. The black and white with the hints of red and that sort of thing. And there was a couple of pages towards the end with the when they're at the nightclub and then walking in the street that looked better. But but ultimately the art and the coloring needs to step up a little bit. But I'm intrigued and I'm gonna check out the next issue. You know, I like the concept. And if you listen to iFanboy Don't Miss last week when we talked to Joe Keating about it and he kind of revealed some of the directions it may go and it sounds intriguing. So.
I think the production really hurt the book. It didn't seem as high quality as you'd expect from an image comic.
Yeah. It was a challenge.
Venom, I held the book and I was like, do I want to do this? And I saw Remender and Tony Moore. So I'll tell you this right now. If you tell me that I want to do this, I'm going to get the book. But I didn't get it. So tell me, do I want
it? Oh, you didn't get it? Yeah,
no,
you
no.
want
Okay.
Yeah, you want it.
I just here's what it feels like. This book was real good. This book wasn't selling, so we have to do something else with this book. And I don't want to do something else. I want to do what we were doing. And I understand that not everybody was into that, and I'm fine with it. But that's, you know, I mean, that is what happened, right? I mean,
I don't know.
You don't know, but it's different now, obviously, because it's Ghost Rider, Girl, Wolverine, and
well, this is the last story of the of that event. Mm-hmm. It's back to just Venom now after the next issue. So I mean, yeah, it's not. But this whole 5-week Venom event turned out to be really, really satisfying. Like, it turned out to be really kind of crazy and kind of, you know, like, you know, hell takes over Vegas and this unlikely group gets together and the Spirit of Vengeance and the Symbotei go onto the Red Hulk in
whoa,
this issue.
Whoa.
You can't steamroll past that one.
No. But, say the word symbiote.
I can't
for us.
Say it. Symbiote. Symbotei.
Symbotei sounds like some mid-80s
ninja
movie.
That's like Kumite. That's where Frank Dukes went to fight and his symbiote. Underground martial arts tournament.
Well, you're putting an accent on the E at the end.
Symbotei.
Everyone knows secret is Symbotei. Oh, very good.
Symbotei.
A man find his sword, climb a mountain of a Symbotei.
So the symbiote and the Spirit of Vengeance merge with the Red Hulk and making a badass Hulk Venom Ghost Rider, which was awesome. And then towards the end, you get Tony Moore drawing the Avengers. I've never seen Tony Moore draw Captain America.
Can't I just have a room with a legless man who's sad about his dad drinking? That's what I wanted from this.
Yeah, this was really good. It was good. So I would say go back and pick it up.
I know exactly. My tastes are clearly not the symbiote of the masses or the Symbotei of the masses.
Symbotei.
I'm finally going to get that Criterion Collection DVD of Akira Kurosawa's Symbotei. which is Japanese for rebar.
Those are almost all the books we wanted to talk about. There's one more we'll talk about later in the show. But you can go to ifanboy.com/comics. You can make your pull list. You can rate and review your books. And you can make your own pick of the week. And we like to run down the top five user picks of the week for this week. And number five was Rachel Rising, number six, with 1.2%. Number four was Ultimate Comics Spider-Man, with number eight, with 1.2%. So they were tied. Number three was Action Comics, number seven, with 4.4%. Number two was The Manhattan Projects, number one, 34.9%. And number one, the powerhouse Swamp Thing, number seven, with 51.7%.
All right.
Akamu reviewed Ferris, number one, which is the new spin-off series from the Fables universe.
Ooh, are you excited?
I didn't buy it. Uh-huh. I'm holding it right here. No, I haven't read it. He says, the only thing that really worked for me in this book was the art, which is superb. From Adam Hughes's cover through every page of Jimenez's pencils, Lanning's inks, and Dalhaus's colors, this is a gorgeous book. Each artist's work complements the other, even though the ifanboy.com ad is beautiful. I didn't see that. I didn't mean to put that in. I'm going to give the title two more issues, and that's 20%. But that's 20% of my faith that Willingham will make this into an engaging story, and 80% respect for the visual artist. He gave the story a 2 out of 5, and the art a 5 out of 5. And the pick of the week percentage was 0.2%. I stopped reading Fables, and I was like, I don't really want to read.
Yeah, they're doing this whole big they're doing this whole. Apparently, this is the Vertigo segment of the user reviews, by the way, too. Yeah. But yeah, they're doing this whole Vertigo relaunch thing, and it looks like they're trying to put Ferris out in the lead, like as the next great Fables kind of thing, and just keep going to that well.
Yeah, well, you know, Jack of Fables was really good, and I liked that they ended it and then just let it go forever. But
people love that Cinderella book.
Yeah, that's Chris Roberson, right?
Yeah.
It's a good. I will tell you, The Fairest is a good looking book. You know, you can't argue with Phil Jimenez, who I don't feel like I've seen all that much, and Andy Lanning, who in addition to co writing excellent books, is one excellent anchor.
He's a fine anchor.
Yeah. Jimenez does film work, which is why he disappears from comics every now and then. They go back to this well because it's a deep well full of money.
Yeah. Can you say that again, but in the voice of Ron Swanson? Go to the well.
So yeah, well, I don't blame him. So maybe Fables fan likes it. Who knows? All right, our next Vertigo review comes from Kingdom of Evan, who reviewed Sweet Tooth number 31 and gave the story a 4 out of 5 and the art a 4 out of 5, and nobody made it their pick of the week. And Kingdom of Evan got pretty creative with his review, which is a haiku. And the review is: while Jeopard's tied up, Gus steps up to save the day. It's about time, yo.
Yeah. That's you know, he got there because of that. Let's be honest.
Yeah, no, I like the creativity of that. That was good.
We haven't moved a lot.
We don't hear talk on this book as much as we did in the beginning.
Not much happens with it.
Yeah.
It's been very similar the whole way through, and like we've been stuck at this dam that was kind of interesting, and there was a big twist on the person who's there, and there's good stuff that happens in this. It's a really decompressed book. I mean, he's not rushing through it, which is kind of good. I'm sure it reads fine later, which is what, you know, if you think back to the earliest stuff that Lemire did that we all really liked, but on an issue by issue basis, it starts to get a little Long in the Tooth, and I'm not going to stop reading it. I bought every issues, and I'm going to. When it's ending relatively soon, right? Or am I wrong about that?
I feel like it's on the way to ending, maybe in the 40s, maybe, but I still think there's a way to go. I think he's starting to wrap it up, but I don't know for sure. I'm buying it. I will continue to buy it because I just love Lemire's artwork and I'll look at it. But I can't remember the last. Like if someone said what's going on, Sweet Tooth, I can't really be like, oh, you know, like it just feels very stalled and like it didn't have the emotional punch that some of the issues in the early 20s had. You know,
I feel like every time I get to the end of it, I was like, oh, that's the end. Like it sneaks up on me really fast, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it always leaves you feeling a little short, I guess.
Yeah. I gotta drink this coffee hot.
Ooh, Mickey Seals. No, I'm done with him. I can't.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's hard. I know.
It is hard.
Me too. But yeah.
Okay, so go to fanboy.com/comics, rate, review your books, write a review, make it good, and we'll get it on the show. If it's not a review about a book, we talk about. So keep that in mind. Yeah. You all write Avengers reviews, you probably won't get on the show because we're going to talk about it. So let's do a couple of emails. The first one's from Benjamin. Benjamin writes and says, everyone knows which superheroes are most permeated in the pop culture, Batman, Superman, Spider-Man. But why these particular heroes and not others? I think a big contributing factor is that most people know who those heroes are underneath their cowls. Batman is Bruce Wayne, Superman is Clark Kent, Spider-Man is Peter Parker. With other heroes, the lines are more blurred. Who is Green Lantern? Who is the Flash? When there are multiple characters donning the same costume and hero identity, it dilutes the individuality of the character. It makes them less special and less unique, not to mention that it plays into the popular perception that superhero comics are needlessly esoteric. What do you guys think?
I think you're wrong.
I'm inclined to agree with you, but not as vehemently.
Well, no, the point being, the people that...
Wait, agree with who, Benjamin or Josh?
Josh.
The reason that people know those characters' secret identities is because they know the characters. It's not the other way around.
Right.
Why are those characters so popular? That's an interesting question to me. Superman is the superhero, so he's the sort of first one who really caught on in the public consciousness, and we've never let go of it because it's so... simple.
It's a primal, pure thing. It's what all superheroes are based off. There are some very interesting.
Batman is the other side of that coin. Yeah. It's the dark to the light of that. And it's such a simple. It's a man. He has no special powers. Just his own motivation, basically, and a goal. And it's a striking visual image too. I think that has a lot to do with it. And then you move forward to the 60s, and Spider-Man really represents the idea that, hey, what, let's take these superheroes and make something more complex and interesting out of them.
Well, I think Spider-Man is the reason why the phenomenon of Spider-Man is that Spider-Man took, you know, kind of elements of what was going on Superman and Batman and the other heroes before and then made it relatable. Mm-hmm. It was the kid that was in your math class, yeah. Or it was that dude that who was always trying to make rent and that sort of thing, and it became it's the absolute shining example of the Stan Lee or Steve Ditko Marvel kind of real world. Relatable, actual, you know, could exist in New York City approach. Much more so than Fantastic Four.
But in that case, he's much more tied into the secret identity.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I think it plays into – I think Spider-Man plays into him more. I don't think the reason is as cut and dry as Benjamin says, but I think Peter Parker is as much the reason Spider-Man's popular as Spider-Man. I think Batman – and Superman is less about their identities.
It's not that people know who they are, though. That's what he's.
No, but I disagree. I think the Batman. I don't know, give or take. But the Clark Lois thing, I think, is a big part of the Superman mythos. Is the secret identity being the love triangle amongst essentially two people. Lois being in love with Superman, Clark being in love with Lois, and no one being in love with Clark.
They're more popular because they're better characters. They're the best ones that they've come up with. Yeah. And the Green Lantern is weird. What the fuck is a lantern? What does a lantern really have to do? Like, it doesn't. It's not clear. It's not straightforward. It's interesting from a sort of, you know, like if you look at sort of the supporting characters, he can be completely interesting, but it's not going to hit a major social consciousness. And then when the movie's a piece of shit, that doesn't help.
Right. Yeah. And they do have a problem with the who is Green Lantern because they're it's that multiple and also probably with the Flash too as to because there are multiple people holding that mantle in the comics. It's hard to translate that, and especially when Green Lantern for years you've had John Stewart in the cartoon, and that's kids know that, and then they bring back Hal Jordan, at least in terms of the public consciousness goes not what we know as comic fans.
The thing that this got me thinking about is there anybody else who's at that level who's come out in that time that can compare with those. And yeah, I had a hard time thinking of something else. Captain America, maybe the next closest, or actually maybe, God, Iron Man took everybody by surprise, but I wonder if that really had more to do with Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, no, I would say Iron Man now because of the movies, but before the movies, I don't think anybody knew that Iron Man was Tony Stark and that sort of thing.
But that changed it.
Yeah, I think Captain America is as big as but not because of Steve Rogers, because of Captain America.
More the imagery of it. People don't know who Steve Rogers is or that story. They do now. Again.
Yeah.
The movies had a lot to do with it, but I think you can see that these characters were the characters even before those movies.
Yeah.
You know, Batman has been in movies all along, so is Superman. Actually, Spider-Man 2 to a slightly lesser extent, you know, but, there are – you can.
Oh, man, do you remember those 70s Spider-Man?
Yeah.
With the, God.
Yeah, I really wanted to like those, but that was rough.
Yeah.
But, you know, but if you look, every decade has its version of the Batman or Superman, you know, movie or serial or TV show or something like that. Every single one. And they just work throughout different different eras and changing. They're just really – good, flexible, interesting characters.
I think Thor to a certain degree, but not because of the comic, just because of the mythology.
Yeah, I go back to
Adventures in Babysitting.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, I mean, like what that was, you know, like the fact that the kid was into Thor, and that was like,
but that's not a Marvel character, though. It's a
right. That's what I mean, because of the character
they
itself.
Know that, like they know, you know, who Zeus is or who.
Right. That's what I mean, but it helps the comic character.
Also, Thor doesn't really have a special secret identity that people know about.
Sigurd Jurlson.
Yeah. Donald Blake.
Simbote.
He wasn't even in the movie. He didn't even have a secret identity in the movie.
I know.
He didn't.
It's an interesting question, though.
Yeah. It's.
I don't think it's why. I just think that the characters are they tap into something.
Mm-hmm. Why is anything successful? Why, you know, like it's hard. That's what everyone's trying to recreate, is that they're the model of what the success has been, you know. And that's the thing, like, you know, Superman, Batman, you know, the Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. I'm Wonder Woman, maybe. They don't know that she's Diana Prince.
But, yeah, but they know her. But again, you know, TV show in the 70s, like that goes a long way.
I think Wonder Woman is the Captain America analog. It's the imagery and that thing. But
she is.
But you've got those characters, and then you go over at Marvel, and it really – Spider-Man really triggered it. And yeah, Fantastic Four was first, but like it's nowhere near the zeitgeist of Spider-Man. And even, you know, X-Men and all stuff like that, they've had their, you know, moments of popularity, and Iron Man's going through it now. But Spider-Man, he's on the checks. I mean, like, he's the one that everyone knows. And
it was almost Wolverine, but Wolverine's more like a pop culture totem than these things, which are sort of stick around for a really long time.
Yeah, that entombed.
Also, Wolverine's not about Logan. I mean, no one, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not as tied in.
No, I agree.
Right.
In the public view.
I agree. Yeah, it's like a Care Bear with claws. It's just a symbol.
Nice.
Seriously.
Yeah, it's true.
It's not that much different.
All right, on to our next email. Email from Joshua writes in, says, so I've got this friend. Sure.
Uh-oh.
I've got this friend who really enjoys comic book movies, but really hasn't read very many actual comics. Currently, he's really excited about the Avengers and has come to me asking what were some Avengers comics he should read. For a few seconds, I considered telling him to check out some of the stuff that Bendis has been doing over the last few years, but instead decided to have him read Avengers Forever instead, due to how that book kind of boiled down to the essence of the Avengers in 12 really great issues. So my question for you is, for certain characters, what would you consider their definitive book? A book that takes the character or group of characters and showcases everything that makes them great in a pretty bite-sized format, such as stories like All-Star Superman or Batman Year One. What would you consider the definitive book for characters like The Flash, The X-Men, Green Lantern, or others? Also, are there any characters that you don't really think have a definitive story yet, despite being around for quite a while? Another good question, and also where he answers it in the question. Why'd you take All-Star Superman away from me?
We're done.
Well, The Flash doesn't have that story. Green Lantern doesn't have that story.
Well,
no,
I don't think. I don't think Green Lantern doesn't have that.
You don't think the Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams stuff?
No, it's not.
That was more about an era than a character.
And even like, you know, Rebirth was designed to be that, but it ain't that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get a Green Lantern story. My favorite Green Lantern story, the one that
Secret Origin
for both of those characters is still New Frontier.
Yeah.
You know, that's if only just in terms of Hal Jordan, but I think that they handle the Flash really well in that story too. And it's like, what is that guy? It's that. That's going to give you an overview of what the DC universe should be about. But it's hard. I mean, there was Green Lantern Secret Origin that was okay.
But I guess Sinestro Corps War was just good. It wasn't definitive, though.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really – it kind of give you
it's
Hal
not,
Jordan
it's not
as he
like
is.
All-Star Superman. It's not like The Dark Knight Returns. You can hand someone a book and say, this is Green Lantern.
Or Batman. He mentions Batman Year One, which is, straight. It's not that it's an origin story. That's not it. And Superman, All-Star Superman is not an origin story. It's a story.
It's definitive. Yeah. It's
right.
I got to say, I wouldn't have said Avengers Forever. That shit was...
Yeah, no, I think Avengers Forever is too heavy, to be honest.
Ponderous.
And
I don't even mean that in a bad way. It's some hardcore...
I don't even know what I guess the Kree-Skrull War is definitive Avengers.
I mean, you could read the first couple trades of Bendis's New Avengers or something like that.
That
would be fun. That would get you what you wanted. That Avengers is hard too, but it's just because it's been ongoing for such a long time. They haven't really rebooted it that many times. You know, I would have said I don't know how well it's aged, but when Busiek took over Avengers. I think that started with number one in the late 90s. That would be a good place to go, I think.
So Ron, what's the definitive X-Men story?
I mean, it's Dark Phoenix. I mean, that's absolutely Dark Phoenix. As much as I love the Paul Smith stuff, which is a close second, as much as I love the the Jim Lee stuff, I mean, it's Dark Phoenix.
What's funny is
a definitive story has to be – you've got to hand them in one book and say this is the X-Men.
You know what? When I was 12, Dark Phoenix is the first X-Men story I ever read, and I've never read anything that even came close.
No, it sets up – because what you got with the Dark Phoenix is that it sets up the concept of mutants. It sets up the recruitment with Kitty and with Dazzler and all that sort of – with the stuff early on. And then it brings in a threat. It brings in a villain. And then there's sacrifice with Jean ultimately sacrificing herself. Yes, there's stuff that came before that you're benefited by knowing. Like it starts with them just finishing the Proteus thing and they're in Scotland and there's Madrox. You're like, who the fuck are these people? But it doesn't matter. No. You don't need it. You don't need it at all.
Also,
yeah.
It sets up Wolverine.
Yes,
good
it does.
As anything, in a supporting role, not a lead role, but his whole character's there. Everything comes from there.
Yep. So,
if you wanted Wolverine, it would be the Miller Claremont series.
Yeah, probably. So, who else is he asking for? Flash Green? Yeah, I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Trying to think other characters that have definitive character stories. That's a tough one. I need to go look through my library.
It's hard. I mean, like we do these Where Do I Start series, and we just did Hawkeye. You know, like Hawkeye's not a lot of characters. There's only a few of them who can be sort of definitive, real sort of strong main supporting characters. Hawkeye's not. Somebody else pointed up Black Widow's not. Like when you put Black Widow on her own, it falls flat.
But also you need the confluence of creator and character and story, and it's hard to make a definitive story.
What's
Daredevil? Oh, it's Miller.
Is it Miller or is it?
Yeah, it's absolutely Frank Miller.
Yeah, it's
the Elektra,
what's the Mazzucchelli stuff?
Born Again,
definitely.
Yeah,
but that's again that they weren't setting out to make the definitive story. It just so happened that way.
Right.
But that's the thing is I don't think anybody sets out to do the definitive story. I think it just a story emerges and it becomes definitive. I mean, like Batman Year One. I don't think Miller and Mazzucchelli were doing the definitive Batman. They were just telling Batman Year One.
Walt Simonson.
I don't think that's the definitive Batman story, by the way.
What do you think is the definitive Batman story?
Dark Knight for sure. Year One's more about Gordon than Batman. I mean, you can't really have a definitive story about a character and have the story be mostly about somebody else.
That's fair. I won't argue. It's not my character. I won't argue. No. Okay, cool. So good question. If you have any other good questions like that, shoot us an email, contact@ifanboy.com. On to the voicemail, and our first voicemail is talking about a book that came out this week.
Hey, guys. This is Logan from South Carolina, and I just read Green Arrow number 7, and I am seriously just about to cry or something because this was, if not just as horrible, if not more horrible than the previous arc. Oliver Queen looks like he's a 12-year-old boy in an adult's body. The writing was just horrible. The artistry was just somewhere off in left field. Basically, what my question is this worth keeping on? I'm a big Green Arrow fan. I didn't want to stop reading it. I don't know if it's going to get any better. If you guys could help me out, I need any decision here. Keep it or drop it. I don't know what to do anymore. Thank you, guys. Bye.
Logan, put the book down.
It's time to walk away.
Put the book down. I'm gonna listen. Drop it. Now let's talk more in detail about it. It's okay.
Well, so Connor picked this in the light week, saying, "Hey, it's a new creative team. I'll give it a shot." Right.
Well, Dan Nascenti, speaking of Daredevil, the classic Daredevil writer,
And I didn't buy it, but I read it in the store. And after that first page, I just laughed. I was like, "What the hell is this?"
It was the most exhausting book I've read, and not in a good way. The art was like so busy, and we won't even get to the fact that he did look like a 12-year-old boy whose head on a body of a man. But the story
the concept is miserable.
The story was such a breakneck pace that, and again, not in a good way. That there was no time to rest or breathe. They just move from one scene to another. I gotta go here. I gotta go do this. I gotta do that. And then by the time it was over, you're just like between your eyes being tired from the art and the story never stopping. It was bad in a different way than the first issue was bad.
which honestly I didn't think was possible. Oh man, yeah, I couldn't. I mean, like, I had problems with the initial first one. Like, they've ruined this character. I go back to what I said when Green Arrow number 1 came out, when J.T. Krull wrote it with that first issue, and I said I feel bad for Green Arrow fans.
Well,
because if they did this stuff to my character, you sound like poor Logan. Can someone check on him?
But listen, Logan, there's hope, because you know it might be like this for a little while, but eventually it'll change. It might not change back. It might be something else. It might take a while, but it'll change. Like, because obviously this isn't gonna work. You know, like it's not. It's not the thing that it's. I don't hear anybody out there like, this is a great book and sales going through the roof. They're gonna have to make a change eventually. But I think across this relaunch, you're seeing a lot of different things happen.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, and because we got another caller who has a question related to that.
Hey, this is Andrew from the Jersey Shore, and I was just wondering, why do you guys think Nathan Edmondson got off of Grifter and got replaced by Rob Liefeld? To me, he's good in his own right, and I thought he was going to make Grifter great, but it hasn't been amazing. Not that I don't like the comic. I'm still buying it every Wednesday. But it seems like Nathan has this affinity for indie comics. Like, he has the Activity launching with Image, and you know, Who is Jake Ellis and its sequel. And I just want to know if, like, Nate, what do you guys think? Did you think push came to shove between him and DC, or what? Or could he not have, or was he not capable to keep up with a monthly book?
So, Andrew, to answer your question, we don't know why Nathan Edmondson got off that book, just like we don't know why they bought Anno Senti on the Green Arrow. There's oftentimes we get a lot of transparency into when people leave books, and you get people writing blog posts and tweeting about it and stuff like that. But sometimes which is one side of the story, yeah. But a lot of times we never hear what the other side of it is. And it could just be that, you know, for whatever reason, maybe Edmondson's schedule is too big, or maybe he couldn't handle the monthly thing, or maybe DC Editorial didn't like what he was doing. And that's the real point to point Josh was making earlier, is that they're going to make changes whenever they feel like it. And that sometimes it could make a book better. It can make a book worse. It can make a book worse in a different direction. And there's always that hope that a change will bring about. And this is like Green Arrow, like in a year or two from now, Green Arrow is primed to be one of those, like, are you reading Green Arrow? Because it's going to become one of those, you know, a book that nobody's reading because it's so bad. They're going to take a lark on somebody new, maybe, or who knows. And then it's going to be one of those things where, wow, look what's going on over here. So it's
this
that
too shall pass.
Yeah, exactly.
It will. And it has to.
Hopefully not into something else equally horrible, which is what has happened.
Yeah, but it might, you know, but then it comes up completely on, you know, Winnick and Chang on Green Arrow, Black Canary was out of the blue. And it was great for a little while. And then it wasn't, and then, you know, it'll come back around. You know, the characters are malleable. There's not a single one of us here who hasn't really liked a character or a book and had it, you know, ripped out from under them like a rug. Yeah. You know, it's you know, whether it's the Orca Lady in Batman, remember that?
Nope.
Hama written Orca Lady.
That was the one arc. But the thing is,
or Ron for 15 years with the X-Men. I mean, it happened. Chuck Austin. I mean, like, we've all been through this. I would say you're a little better off following creators and characters. It doesn't happen quite so much, but
it's just tough when you have as someone who has an emotional connection to characters, it's hard to walk away. It is hard.
The Mark Waid Flash twins. I mean,
yeah, no, I know. Yeah, it's tragic. So, well, but that said, I would advise you to run away from Green Arrow.
Yeah, stop buying.
And really, that's the only way you're going to get your voice heard is to stop buying it.
Yes. Yeah.
Otherwise, sure. if you keep buying it and hating it and sounding like that every Wednesday, then they don't care. They have no incentive to stop. So if everyone who doesn't like it stops buying it, they'll have to change the way it's done.
Buying it and complaining about it online does not work.
No. So, all right. So if you have any other questions, you can call us on our voicemail line at 1-888-FANBOYS. It's 1-888-326-2697. If this podcast wasn't enough for you on Monday.
Did you just slap the table in excitement?
I clapped.
He just fell.
you can tune into iFanboy Don't Miss, which is a short podcast that comes out every Monday on iFanboy.com, and it's available on iTunes. That talks to a creator about a book that you absolutely need to check out when you head to the comic book store. And this week, Paul is talking to our good friend Paul Cornell. It's a party of Paul's.
Fantastic. And,
it's Paul the party animal Cornell talking about his new Vertigo series Saucer Country, which launches this week with artist Ryan Kelly. That's definitely one I'm looking forward to. It's great to see Paul Cornell do some good Vertigo sci-fi. I'm down.
I'm holding it right here. Yeah, I haven't read it yet, but looking forward to it. Yes. You can also check out the Make Comics podcast that I do with Andy Schmidt from Comics Experience, where we try to, if not answer, then at least explore some of the issues that you may want to be thinking about as you go to make comics, whether from whatever standpoint that is, or you just want to appreciate the art form and how stuff gets done a little more. But they're really fun shows to do.
And if you saw John Carter this weekend, or you plan on seeing it, you want to hear people talk about it, you can come listen to the special edition podcast on John Carter, which will be behind the show on the feed or on iFanboy.com or anywhere we have the show. You can find it chatting about the latest big summer movie.
This book looks great, by the way.
Summer movie?
Is it?
No.
Spring?
It's March.
It feels like it should be a summer movie.
It's literally still winter.
Lousy smarch weather.
Just way back. You can go to ifanboy.com for all of that stuff. You can read the Pick of the Week review that I wrote, the Book of the Month, eventually. And I really wasn't even trying to. I was just trying to fill in space, and then it came off as guilting. But whatever works. There's all sorts of discussion going on about the things that are going on in comic books that matter to us and you, or both, by definition. And you can go to ifanboy.com/about, and you can find out about us and where to reach us online and in other capacities, social networking, stuff like that. You can also follow us at twitter.com/ifanboy or facebook.com/ifanboy for more.
And you can email us at contact@ifanboy.com. You can call our voicemail line 888-FANBOYS 326-2697 with any comments, questions, concerns. Get on the show, make it good and fun, and tell us where you are from and who you are.
Yes.
In either order. It's fine.
And if you like what we do, go to iTunes and write a review of this podcast. Helps people discover new podcasts, as well as write reviews for iFanboy Don't Miss. And help spread the word. Tell your comic book store. Tell your friends. Tell your mom. Tell your cousin. Tell your third grade teacher about iFanboy. Help spread the word. We really appreciate it. You guys are our biggest help in getting the word out. So thank you. Cool.
I don't even know how to get a hold of Mrs. Searles.
I'm so glad that I didn't pay for Green Arrow, by the way. Normally, I don't want to be the guy who reads the book in the comic store, but I waited till the end of the day, and then I snuck over in the corner and I read it because I knew that, Connor, you were going to read it, and we're going to talk about it.
Oh, my God. It's just, Josh, if you see it at the store, peer into it and check out the art.
Oh, I thought you were going to say just pee on it. I said, whoa.
I like those guys. I can't do that to their merchandise. Have you been reading it all along?
No.
I bailed after the first issue. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So until next week, I'm Ron.
I'm Connor.
I'm Josh, and do not drive behind a rebar truck.
Whoa.
I think he just peed.